One, a journey. But like a bird, one was always tempted to stop, then fly, then return, then leave. The great movement of a circumference, the globe that had accordingly been circled and posed around by those who could afford to map out places, to take pictures, to make a copy and keep what remained. And indeed, like that German film of angels falling off the sky, and the camera's gaze transfixed on a cat's paw repeatedly hemming forward, the moment could be extended indefinitely, towards an infinity that was approached at the horizon of the sky. I had been keeping this trail of clues to follow, to figure myself in the aforementioned places, only to recoil and leave. But I must have been, if not shaped by these locations, to have had some form of experience that belonged uniquely to each, and in the return, here to Taipei, a place I had at best a fleeting connection, something emerged from the photographs. As an island, was it fated to be the place of entrance? The photographs that documented the old, a number of books that had been published, in the black and white, austere layout that brought the past to light in rectangles. The island where it had been subject and subjected to another rule, revealed to be a chameleon. But the ports remained, and it was with a mask on that I went on to the coast. We hadn't left rooms, the trap of places and thoughts, an impossible swirl of present and the always current, yet with the nagging feeling that somehow reality was out of reach. The window that I had now found myself overlooking in the hotel room was matched by many Gen Z students, their ages noticeable, the interlocking arms of youth that brushed one another, capped by scooter helmets and kawaii bags. Taipei was a young city, like many East Asian cities that were experiencing a population shift, where the young would be required to, for better or worse, shoulder the burden of the aging elders in the future. This was a category I found myself gravitating towards, appearances to the contrary. Perhaps that was why youth was allowed to flourish, its expression was not curtailed by the style and designs of another generation. My own time appeared grimy, a long-lost VHS that had been put aside in a locker, an old trope if there was one, left to rot for posterity. Watching these kids walk by, I couldn't help but wonder if the tape, rewound, could replay certain scenes in the cityscapes of Philadelphia and Brooklyn, the jagged concrete skylines juxtaposed with a ghostly techno soundtrack. A single with a cloying plea for love or some such thing, matched with a British beat and lyrics about the catchiness of a telephone. An intimate view of nowhere, and yet this was all too old in the 1980s, hardly commensurate with the flattened realities of the present. The concrete was replicated here, as was the hanging industrial overlays, walls of temporary provenance with steel shades that concealed construction and destruction. Walking within felt like approaching a capsule of places, with the intent of corresponding with other cities, to be a node in a chain of places. Hence, Geelong was a port, a stopping point for objects, goods, and materials. The Dutch had entered and left in the 1600s, leaving behind forts and parts, the remnants of which were still apparent, the stone lasting past their rule, the overgrowth reclaiming parts of the coastal construction. I had walked past the long shophouses, this unique style found in another coast across the Atlantic that they had sailed to, Brooklyn, Brooklyn, marshland and villages, the same townhouses at the precipice of the Pacific coast, Formosa, Isla Formosa. And I was reminded of another sidewalk where the sun beat down unceasingly, the hot and humid shadows of my mother's town, another location in the world housing European remnants, the British-built railways and their goods extracted from the tropical jungle. And yet, I experienced the busy everyday of people pushing carts in the narrow side streets, their routines a reductive, steady rhythm complemented by steel cage-like housing, reinforced against the outside world. The townhouses overlapped and were, for the most part, sites where one could draw together a series of encounters between settlers and the settled, which left traces on places either haunted or evacuated of their past. In a move from townhouse to city, one always encountered the following: the warm invitation of those whose livelihoods depended on your entrance, her smile perhaps a mix of genuine feeling and business, their families having settled and arrived earlier than you, a tourist of place, a visitor of lands, a masked entrance who, at some point, needed to be fed and housed, if only for a temporary stay, like the desert travelers, a swordsman without a horse, a one-eyed bandit in the tavern. And there were many examples, the outlaws with a scraggly need for meat and drink and bed, sooner or later to be plowed and depped. The seafood establishment was out of the neon persuasion, neon itself an art, dying out in the age of the LED, that had originally connected and lit the shophouses, across continents and as the backdrop to many a jungle and subtropical tree. Perhaps lighting as the boats docked, the men and women gathered at the coastline, now young couples on bicycles. The catch of the day in the steaming metal platter, fire roaring underneath to keep it warm, flesh falling off small bones as one picked at the garlic. A visitor entering the shop, a townhouse that was already there, and my peering at the entrance of a glass door, spying the ongoing dinner of men and family, the thronging visitors who perhaps felt at home. Families congregated at this place, the Geelong Port, a place of entrance coveted and developed by nearly all the entering states-to-be. It had, after years of this history, become somewhat abandoned, less important in the scale of today's sand and cement-driven constructions, reflecting the relative decline of the ship in one's imagination of the globe. The plane had overtook its landing, had become the preferred way of connecting place to place at ever-increasing velocities. Something about the romance of the open air, the slowness of the ocean breeze persisted, but it had become subsumed by speed, to be categorized as a predecessor to the speedy denouement of travel, the fast shuttling between continents, achievable by virtue of the use of oil, a burning of shared deaths accumulated underground. It was no coincidence that in the past, the bereaved lit fires to send off their dead to rest along the water, a striking image I had seen once in a documentary about an Indian village, though I could very well imagine that similar practices had taken place here, this brink of a coast that seemed inviting to all who had discovered it for the first time, ignorant of predecessors. A coast was now an amusement park, local families swimming with carefree innocence around the crags dotted by unusual-looking mushroom-like rocks. They seemed like outcrops of an era that perhaps began this process of accumulation of animals, plants, seaweed, life itself, converted into slow sediments and fossils, into things to burn and energize one day. And yet it was marked by forts left behind, the human, Dutch-built defenses at the coastline, to be superseded by the defense radar against raiding air forces, the enemies having changed, even though the position of the island had not. From pirates to bandits, the language was remarkably consistent, even though separated by centuries. Just as the shipping containers persisted, despite now taking a backseat in the airways of our imagination. Though even that felt obsolete in the age of holographic transmission, whose distance was to be closed by a mere click of the finger, a magic doubtlessly stunning to the voyagers and explorers of yore, whose physicality was invested in the journeys they undertook. For each unmoored moment could spell danger. But the goods would keep on going, in the background that one took for granted, or at least it had seemed so before, when the dream of a completely flattened world had been portrayed by some exuberant writers and thinkers as one without history, despite the great unevenness in the world hierarchy. The lack of travel of the past year had vanished amidst the ocean, through the tingle of salt that entered one's eyes. It felt real, unlike the cartographic maps, abstractions meant to deliver a sense of control over the space, to provide a guide where otherwise would be a blue expanse. The salt had its own journey, a material breeze that could possibly only be understood in sediments, each grain a history of movement, too minute to be documented, even with the overseeing eye of the planet. And who knew if this personification of the Earth, the metaphor of a physical embodiment, the reversal of our relation with place, was actually a balanced objective entity, the nature that in our time had become a poster, a picture, an image.
Two, space. The ability of Taiwanese manufacturers to move rapidly from production in Taiwan to production in Guangdong or Fujian province is largely a function of the unprecedented physical mobility of manufactured goods and machinery. Shoes made 1 month in Taiwan are suddenly made a month later in Guangdong at greatly reduced cost. The shoes are identical, only the label registers the change. And even labels can be falsified when import restrictions are to be circumvented. The flow of cargo to Japanese or North American or European markets is never interrupted. A ship leaves Hong Kong with its 40-foot steel boxes full of sneakers rather than Keelung or Kaohsiung. Alan Sekula, Fish Story.
To the feng shui worshipping literati, no more important place could exist. Yet the hill, owing to its many fishes, tempted numerous unthinking labourers to go to it for building material, which could be easily excavated. But the literati, during the reign of the Emperor from 1735 to 1796, under the belief that the geomantic influence of the whole island was involved, became alarmed at the desecration, and as a result of their representations, a tablet was erected directing that the hill be not disturbed and threatening dire punishment to all unheeding children. The so-called caverns were in reality openings in the coal measures. The presence of this useful mineral was not unknown to the villagers, and while apparently giving the instructions of the mandarins due attention, Keelung residents did not want for fuel. Furthermore, needy persons were inclined to visit the outcroppings in the neighbouring hills and gather a few baskets of coal for market. Other persons of low birth were likewise willing to risk the total destruction of the island by the angry genii and joined in the lucrative occupation. This was too much, and in 1835, the gentry and literati united in a petition to the Tamsui district officer, who reported on the subject to the provincial government. This resulted in a second tablet, the former having disappeared, doubtless not without assistance. To ensure its permanency, this tablet was of stone, and on its surface was engraved, in peremptory wording, the declaration that the mining of coal was absolutely and for all eternity prohibited. But the foolish, unemployed country people still persisted in disturbing the geomantic influence, inviting dire disaster on all the peoples, and in 1847, the gentry and others again petitioned, accompanying their document with a scapegoat in the shape of a wretched miner who had been selected for punishment that his fate might be a warning to others. A third prohibitory tablet was now set up. The next year, 1849, the U.S. brig Dolphin visited Keelung. Although the plant was now in every way complete, the machinery serviceable, and the mining experts competent, a great hindrance to the successful working of the mine was the difficulty of obtaining efficient labour. The district in the vicinity of the coal mines is perhaps the most unhealthy in Formosa. Dense jungle abounds, and the gains, which are extremely heavy in these parts, are ordinarily followed by intense heat, causing evaporation which fills the air with vaporous fumes. As a result, a large proportion of the workmen, the first gang of whom were chiefly from the mainland, were stricken down with fever, not a few succumbing to it. It was thus extremely difficult especially in summer, to secure workmen, only about one half of the requisite number being forthcoming. Even those who were obtained were very unsatisfactory. The foreign chief reported that they were very slow to learn and not to be trusted with any task of importance, that their capacity for work was small, and, especially as coal hewers, they accomplished surprisingly little as compared with what coal hewers in other countries can do. The foreigners engaged in the work also suffered greatly from fever, two deaths occurring among them. In 3 years, there were 52 deaths among the Chinese staff, including an interpreter and several clerks, and even the high Chinese official in charge was very ill and forced to give up his position. At last, the doctor was stricken and died, and from that time on, no high Chinese official could be induced to reside in the place, the result being that the control over the Chinese engaged at the mine became very lax. Great inconvenience was experienced owing to the delay in going to Keelung to confer with the chief authority on matters of everyday occurrence, and the successful working of the mine was thus threatened. James Wheeler Davidson, The Island of Formosa, Past and Present.
The archives could be split into two. One, the carving out of the island as a resource hub, the connecting to the world through what was needed in the economy at that point, the raw materials that would power movement, transformation, vehicles, quantifiable objects that were turned into data. Two, the travel journeys of those who had arrived through long distance, Falconer, Bird, names of travelers who arrived not by their natural power, but by the constructed power of the ship, a technology that was by its very shape and form a kind of meeting of armor. This brought a warlike footing amidst seas to carry others bristling with weaponry and resource, not so much a meeting of minds as a meeting of hulks and battering rams. A panicked and unequal meeting in the south, a trade finally made with the gunship, but the images and metaphors of travel still circulating in the text that was recollecting, places that would be known through these sediments of times, shards of bucolic images that were taken away from the natural, the represented and unrepresented in the boundaries of a book that was in itself to be opened, to be printed, to be condensed into the inimitable circulation of words that were the lifeblood of any attempt to enter a place. Place instead of words, words instead of place, a map that was made of the desire to speak, to combine in retrograde the objects that had been marked out as picturesque, as worthy of capture, to be focused on a mental destination that was yet unknown but calling out in echoes, the border of fantasy, the edge of delirium, the thread of things to come. Words to be spoken, to be torn apart, to be combined, to be determined, to be becoming.
Three, colonized images. The image of a port, the sea captured in an instance of its transformation, the ongoing space that had been marked out as a potential resource node, materials to be remade into moving parts. Human entrances and exits, accompanied then by objects transported through a container, the slow drift of time accelerated. Travel, as a slow horizon of fortune and frontier, condensed into this material framework. The literal construction of places on a sea, to not drift, but to expand. To escape the contingent and inure oneself against all that was dangerous about the sea. If the sea was a wall, one could imagine the barrier being torn down through this acceleration, this part of a ship, an engine. And later, the reconstruction of sea as land, the sands not of time, but of space turned into tides. Sand as a building material, as foundation for things to come, as futurity, the way fuel would overtake wind, to conquer the monsoon that had brought me to Formosa, the shape of an island to come. The first traveller may have been non-human, or rather, it was the human interpretation of an entity that had been travelling within Earth and atmospheric systems that were always already circulating, the words finding their way to another planet, a jagged crater that had already disappeared as the words were attempting a landing, the landing a fiction that was, not is, the south disappearing, fading, even as it was being described, in 1575, 1682, 1871, 1925. The Earth system that emerged as it was being extracted, remapped as a resource, the places that had been mechanized, transformed into a world system that was stacked, overturned in its splendor, given a meaning that later travelers would find difficulty in understanding. How the world was connected, how it had been sucked out of the water and repurposed as land, as dry dwelling, steel homes, as a place of walking, of disaster running towards space. The biology of the Earth carried things to be consumed, to be digested through each of us, then removed by a process that had brought us this far in the journey of a connected Earth, a connection that was primordial and not reducible to the late technology of the human, an arrival that was unpredictable yet wholly consequential, to the point that one could look back and ask if the present had been predetermined to this past, if it had been the destination of all its inhabitants. Perhaps biology was to be superseded by geology, fossils replacing the living time for death, a time that would extend as a static piece, the ending and the beginning reconnected through the earth, its plates, its quiet iron and smelted copper, its lost gold. If space was, as during the age of the global, the final frontier, it was because the past frontiers had been retracted by the invisible world system, where the resource elsewhere was magically transported, reached one's destination without a whiff of place or transport. The part that Keelung played in this large symphony of places, a coordinated movement of objects, goods, and raw materials, the colony's experiment all those years ago that would prefigure the world as it was today. Travel and its circumference, thought as trading routes that would map the world as adventure, as conquest, as embodiment of another moving part, the past known as a rough globe that could be flattened by way of mechanization. The horizon contained, through the containers that were invented as home for goods, the trips concealed within barges, ships, otherwise hulks of metal that would move seemingly unobstructed across the seascape, holding things within that could be revealed in all their splendour across the continents. It was a planet still waiting to be colonised, the southern frontier, the ever-expanding fire of mining and smelting, to be forged and then stamped on a map that bore a royal emblem, to become, to transform, to find something else, to encounter a place whereby the inorganic had replaced the organic, carbon converted to air, words replaced by image, a past that had no signpost, except for the waters without end, recorded as a message that was inscribed in the earth. Oh, the south, Nan Fang Ji Ho Feng, Salem Dari Tangara, the travel diaries of an unknown southern figure.